From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Welcome to Bell Atlantic.
We're sorry. Due to the work stoppage, we are not able to provide an operator at this time. Please place your call later.
A look at the issues behind the Bell Atlantic walkout. 73,000 workers are on strike. No, those aren't frustrated callers. They're the screams of environmentalists after police applied pepper spray directly to their eyes. Well, they're in court today. And a look at Tanzania after the blast. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Investigators today began to piece together evidence from last week's U.S. Embassy bombings with a Kenyan guard's eyewitness account providing information that could be important. The twin bombings in Kenya and Tanzania claimed at least 217 lives, including 12 Americans, and injured nearly 5,000. Another 15 bodies were pulled from the rubble in Nairobi today, bringing the death toll in Kenya to 207. 10 Africans died in the bombing in Tanzania. No one's been pulled alive from the wreckage since Saturday, the day after the bombings. The East African Standard said a guard and his colleagues, armed only with short wooden clubs, confronted five men, barring them from the main entrance to the embassy and forcing them to drive to the rear parking lot. The attackers then jumped from the truck and opened fire with automatic rifles. At least one Marine returned fire, and one of the attackers threw a hand grenade. Moments later, the truck exploded. This again, according to the guard. Meanwhile, in Tanzania, a dozen people, including Sudanese and Iraqis, were detained, but U.S. officials played down the importance of the roundup. At the wrecked U.S. embassy in the Tanzanian capital of Dar es Salaam, a dozen FBI agents swept and raked the road, collecting and going through debris. Federal law enforcement officials in Washington said investigators believe the Tanzania bomb was attached to a water truck that serves the embassy and was triggered by remote control, apparently without the driver's knowledge. The New York Times reported today that a CIA agent was killed in the Nairobi explosion. The agent was not identified, the Times said, citing the agency's practice of not publicizing the names of agents. Two buildings housing U.S. Embassy offices in the capital of Swaziland were evacuated today following a bomb threat, this according to the country's police. Police there said they received a phone call saying there were bombs in the Central Bank of Swaziland building, which houses the U.S. Embassy, and at Embassy House, which has some other offices used by the U.S. mission and an American library. After the police search of the buildings, evacuated staff were allowed to return to work. The fate of 18 foreign activists held in Burma for distributing pro-democracy leaflets was unclear today, as the military government accused the group of being part of a plot. Thailand's foreign minister said in Bangkok he thought the activists detained on Sunday after handing out thousands of leaflets at Rangoon tourist sites might be charged. But a government spokesperson declined to confirm rumors that the activists would be tried, saying only the legal process is underway and it would be premature to give comment on the outcome at this moment. Reporting the detention of the activists for the first time, all three of Burma's state-owned newspapers said the group had colluded with, quote, internal axe handles, the term by which the government commonly refers to traitors. They said the plot was arranged outside Burma. Burma police detained six Americans, an Australian, three Thais, three Malaysians, three Indonesians, and two Philippine citizens on Sunday. Meanwhile, Aung San Suu Kyi accused the military junta of putting her under house arrest. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday urged Indonesia to free jailed East Timorese guerrilla leader Xanana Gusmao, quote, sooner rather than later, to let him play a full role in the debate on the country's future. This news from Washington. Hollywood producer Harry Thomason is scheduled to appear today in Washington before independent counsel Kenneth Starr grand jury in the Monica Lewinsky case. Thomason is a close friend of President Clinton, and the president summoned him in January to help handle damage control when the scandal first broke. Fighting has flared between the Angolan armed forces and the UNITA rebel movement in the north of Angola, this according to UN officials. Aid workers said the fighting erupted Friday night and continued into Monday. There are reports that government soldiers wounded in the fighting have been transported to a hospital, but independent observers have denied access to the hospital. State television said 145 people died in clashes over the weekend, but did not say if they were soldiers or civilians. Greenpeace activists stormed a nuclear power plant in northern Germany today and climbed to the top of the reactor to demand its closure. A team of 80 demonstrators from the environmental group descended on the 26-year-old Stade nuclear plant west of Hamburg, some arriving in rubber boats down a nearby waterway. They had unfurled a yellow and black banner at the summit, which read, "End nuclear power now. Shut Stade now." They erected a 25-foot-high switch on top of the reactor with an arrow pointing to the off button. Greenpeace is calling for the immediate closure of the plant and several others that are more than 20 years old. And finally, Kosovo accused Yugoslavia of violating its airspace, saying Serb helicopters were pursuing ethnic Albanians across the border with Kosovo. Meanwhile, 10 Serb policemen were killed by Kosovo-Albanian guerrillas. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Bell Atlantic.
We're sorry. Due to the work stoppage, we are not able to provide an operator at this time. Please place your call later.
A strike by Bell Atlantic workers has disrupted phone service for millions of customers on the East Coast. Union leaders representing 73,000 workers ordered the walkout when the current contract expired at midnight on Sunday. Workers hit the picket lines in 13 northeastern states. Union leaders say Bell Atlantic is looking to hire non-union workers and force current employees to work mandatory overtime. In addition, workers accuse Bell Atlantic of reneging on an agreement to grant retirement packages to 13,000 employees. Bell Atlantic provides phone and internet service to over 40 million people. The company claims the growing demand for service has forced it to hire some non-union workers. The company maintains that any retirement packages promised remain in place, although it's likely they'll have to be delayed. We're joined right now by Bob Master, who's research economist for the Communications Workers of America, CWA. Bob Master is joining us on the phone. I have to say that we did call Bell Atlantic for them to join us as well. Dave Frail, a spokesperson for the company, said they're unavailable to come on the show. However, he did say they're committed to ending the strike. He wouldn't go into details of the contract Bell Atlantic has offered, but says the strike is unnecessary because the company has made a fair offer that addresses the issues raised by the union. Bob Masters, is this true?
I love it when the company tells us that it's unnecessary for us to strike as if we didn't know better. We're small children or something like that. Obviously, we have not been satisfied with the proposals they've made to us up until now, although I will say that I am fairly optimistic that a settlement can be reached relatively quickly.
Tell us what the issues are.
The biggest issue in this strike is the question of job security. Bell Atlantic is a highly profitable company in a growing profitable industry. But despite that, there's been a trend within Bell Atlantic, and quite frankly, it's common throughout the telecommunications industry, to try to move as much of the traditionally unionized work into growing non-union subsidiaries. For example, the company established a non-union customer service center in Virginia called Bell Atlantic Plus, and took several hundred thousand customer accounts out of the hands of unionized business representatives and switched them over to Bell Atlantic Plus, where the non-union workers make $7 or $8 an hour and have fewer benefits and less job security than what we've traditionally enjoyed.
Explain how this fits into the whole deregulation of the telecommunications industry and the telecommunications bill that was passed by Congress.
I think that it's not only the telecommunications bill that was passed, I guess, a year ago or a year and a half ago, but the transformation of the industry, both in terms of ownership structure and technology that has reshaped labor relations in the telecommunications industry since divestiture in 1984. There's an explosion of new services and new businesses. Obviously, the things that you mentioned, like internet, cellular service, the local companies like Bell Atlantic are desperately trying to get into long distance, which is very lucrative. That's the explanation in part behind the proposed merger with GTE. And as those as the companies diversify into these new services, it seems that many of them want to confine the unionized workforce to what we call in the business POTS, plain old telephone service, and build the other companies on a non-union basis. And for us, that's unacceptable. The future of telecommunications marketing is what's called bundled services, where you would come to a company like Bell Atlantic and say, I want a Bell Atlantic mobile account, I want an internet account, I want a local account, and sometime in the future a long-distance account. We feel that if three-quarters of those services are being provided by low-wage workers who don't have the same level of benefits that we've had, there'll be enormous pressure on us to lower our standard of living, and there'll be tremendous pressure to see the work gradually transferred into the non-union subsidiaries. We think that's bad for our members. We think it's bad for the country.
We're talking to Bob Master, research economist for the Communications Workers of America. CWA is on strike. 73,000 workers have walked out, striking against Bell Atlantic. How much does Bell Atlantic lose by this strike in terms of money?
It's very hard to estimate. I think their biggest concerns in a strike situation, and as I said, I am fairly optimistic that we're getting close to the end, their big concern in this situation is, at this point in the history of the telecommunications industry, unlike the way it was even when we went on strike against 9X 9 years ago for 17 weeks, the level of competition is very great, and Bell Atlantic, especially in the business sector, has to worry quite a bit about losing customers permanently to smaller competitors. And so they got this merger with GTE underway. They don't want disruption. I think it's a tremendous incentive for them to get it settled. And quite frankly, we've been working very hard with them to try to work out the problems in a way that will meet the needs of our members.
I can't help thinking about the Puerto Rican telephone company worker strike that just finished up. They are going to be bought by GTE,
right,
which is now merging with Bell Atlantic.
Right. I don't know much about the situation there. My interest in privatization is actually much more closely tied to the state workers that we represent in New Jersey, who have been fighting privatization against Christy Whitman, and we certainly had a great deal of admiration for the general strike that the Puerto Rican telephone workers were able to call to resist the privatization. I gather in the end they won some sweeteners from GTE, but that merger is going ahead. Our union has had a pretty good relationship with GTE over the years, and so we hope that we can be somewhat helpful in making sure that the rights and the interests of the Puerto Rican telephone workers are protected in that transition. It's not something I know a great deal about.
Again, Bob Master, as we wrap up, tell us what you think the final settlement is going to look like, since you think it's going to come pretty soon.
I think that we have the opportunity and the possibility of achieving some historic breakthroughs in terms of protecting the job security of our members. We're negotiating very hard over language that would guarantee that new digital technologies that would facilitate the delivery of things like internet and video and data services directly to people's homes will be kept in our jurisdiction. We think that we can make some progress in addressing some of the shifts of this work that I described earlier, the customer service work to these non-union facilities, and maybe get some of that work back. We're looking at the possibility of converting several thousand temporary employees into permanent jobs with benefits and so on. So I think from the way things are looking right now, we're fairly optimistic that we're going to be able to achieve a settlement that will really guarantee some very meaningful job security to our members, as well as a decent package of wages and benefits. And we think we're looking at a potential of a breakthrough contract.
Bob Master, I know I said that we had a final question, but I've got an even more final question. That's about the media and how it covers the strike. In general, you hear about the inconvenience to millions of phone callers in the Northeast in a case like this. That's how it's usually framed. How do you feel about the media coverage?
Well, I have to say that I've been spending all my time on the phone with the media. The media was very receptive, I think, to our message because we focused very clearly on the issue of protecting decent family-supporting jobs. And it's a concern that resonates with the general public. I think that our issues were not all that different from the issues that were raised by the UPS strike last summer. I think in general there's a greater receptivity to the message of the labor movement now than there might have been 10 or 15 years ago when the labor movement got blamed generally for everything that was going wrong with the American economy. And in this particular instance, Bell Atlantic had kind of a low profile in the media, which was their choice, maybe because they were expecting a settlement quickly, and left the field kind of open for us. So I didn't read or listen to much of the coverage because I was, you know, so busy for a lot of the time, but it seemed to be, in this particular instance, not terribly unfavorable.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Bob Master, with Communications Workers of America. Again, 73,000 workers on strike throughout the Northeast against Bell Atlantic. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Remember these sounds? As many Democracy Now! Listeners might recall, last November, environmentalists staging a sit-in protest in Humboldt County, California, were subjected to a pepper spray attack by authorities. Local law enforcement officials applied pepper spray directly to the eyes of nonviolent protesters who'd locked themselves down with chains. They were protesting a deal being negotiated between the headwaters on the headwaters forest issue in California. When videotape footage of the confrontation was aired on national TV news networks, it created an uproar. Environmentalists scream with pain as the chemicals came into contact with their eyes. They say the authorities' actions amounted to torture. The activists are now suing local law enforcement, challenging the use of pepper spray in nonviolent situations. And the trial began yesterday. We're joined on the phone right now by Spring. She's one of those protesters who were involved with the protests last year. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Spring.
Hello, thank you.
Now, Spring, were you directly involved with this particular protest?
Yes, actually, there were three incidents that happened last fall in Humboldt County, and I was involved in the first incident, the first sit-in.
Describe what happened to you and the protesters you were with. Where were you?
We were in the main headquarters office of the Pacific Lumber Company, which is the company under the direction of corporate suit Charles Hurwitz from Texas. And under his direction, this company is logging the last of the ancient redwood forest in this country, in the world actually, the last of the ancient redwoods on private land. And we went to the headquarters office that day to have a sit-in and to call attention to the trial that was happening beginning on that day, federal government against Charles Hurwitz for his debts to the taxpayers and his savings and loan swindles of the early 80s. We were having a sit-in, singing peacefully, much in a traditional fashion, as many sit-ins have happened over the years in this country and have created great change. And the Humboldt County Sheriff came in and basically gave a dispersal order with the threat of chemical agents.
And then?
And then we were given a five-minute countdown. In that time, people who had asthma told the officers this, basically met with no response on their part. They were going to do this, no matter whether I told them that people with asthma and heart conditions have died from pepper spray. And the countdown was soon to 3 minutes, to 2 minutes, and three people unlocked under the threat of pepper spray, but four of us wanted to resist this excessive use of force by police officers and wanted to hold strong for the forest and for the message and why we were there. And so they came to each person one by one, and when they came to me, they pulled my head back. They wrenched my head back by my hair and my forehead. There were knees in my back and officers all around, as basically I was put in a headlock and they dragged Q-tips soaked in this caustic substance across my eyes several times.
So it was like an operation.
Yes, basically. And we were completely nonviolent the whole time. The movement in Humboldt County is completely nonviolent. Everybody gets a nonviolence training when they come to participate in protests and rallies. And this was such a blatant use of police misconduct and excessive force, especially when we see that this chemical, pepper spray, has not been medically researched extensively at all. And many have actually died.
Spring, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation, and we'll be joined by Karen Pickett as well, Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters participant. After that, we're going to be going to talk about Tanzania, one of the two countries that were bombed last week. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Listener-sponsored radio, KPFA. The time is 9:21 a.m. Coming up at noon today is Living Room with Larry Binsky. Today's topic, memory and the brain. A discussion on the importance of memory in our lives and current research on memory and the brain. And at 2, it's Brainstorm, your own health and fitness with health integration specialist, Lena Berman. That's all this afternoon on KPFA. And now back to Democracy Now!
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the case that went to civil court this week, federal court, beginning yesterday, where nonviolent protesters who had caustic pepper spray applied directly to their eyeballs by law enforcement officials in Humboldt County last fall are, having their day in court. Spring is joining us right now, who is one of the protesters who was at Congressmember Frank Riggs' office in California when the authorities moved in. Spring, did you testify yet?
I haven't testified yet. Today is a big day. As you said, our civil rights case is filed in federal court in San Francisco and should continue for about 3 weeks. Judge Walker is presiding, and in that time, all plaintiffs will testify, as well as many of the officers who were at the incident and applied this.
Hmm. And how old are you, Spring?
I just turned 18, actually.
So you were 17,
I was 17 at
when
the
this
time.
Happened. Mm-hmm. And how many times did they apply the pepper spray? Did you say with Q-tips?
Yes, they used Q-tips. And in subsequent incidents, they actually... from the incident I was in, they decided that they wanted to leave it on longer and escalate to a full spray to the face if people still didn't comply. Because from my incident, nobody did comply who had pepper spray used on them. They had to grind people out. And so the next incident, they sprayed a very close range, about inches basically from people's faces. And still they had to cut people out of the lock boxes.
How exactly did it feel to have the pepper spray directly applied to your eyes?
This was the most pain I've ever felt. There's unbearable burning, and this, as this gets into your lungs, this chemical causes larynx paralysis, and my lungs closed in on themselves. I was hyperventilating as the officers were standing around saying, don't hyperventilate, don't hyperventilate. And I basically had to claw at myself to bear the pain of this chemical. This was very, very painful, kind of like acid eating into your eyes, burning your skin. For much of the time, I was watching my friend and I from above and watching the scene from above.
When this first came to the public attention, we had you on and we played the sounds of the screams, to say the least, very graphic. explain who it is that recorded this. It's not only the sound that we played at the top of the segment, but it was on videotape.
Yes, ironically, there is videotape of each incident that the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department videotaped themselves of every incident. And so we are very lucky in the sense that people can actually see what happened for themselves and really understand what happened. So often, you know, these nonviolent actions on the front lines or in the woods or in the offices don't get that kind of... don't get that kind of clear show of how it was and what happened, and people don't get to see this. So, yeah, the videos pretty much showed what happened to us more than my words could describe, even.
We tried to get the Humboldt County officials on when this first happened, but they refused to comment. Will they be testifying in the trial?
Yes, they will.
Mm-hmm. For the brief time that they did speak before they realized things weren't going exactly their way and the public was not, did not seem to be in support of this kind of surgical procedure, at least done with surgical precision, the applying of pepper spray to your eyes, they said that they stood behind what they did.
Yes, they are actually right now ready to do this again to nonviolent protesters. We didn't receive a temporary restraining order last fall, and so in the subsequent months they have been ready to do this. They actually threatened two people who were using what we call a lockbox, the metal sleeves, and they were locked to a bulldozer that was about to tear up the forest, and this was threatened on them, and they unlocked. And at a protest a few months ago, an unrelated protest, actually, protesting police brutality, not forest issues this time. They were actually issued cotton balls, which is going to be probably the new method that they use instead of Q-tips, and pepper spray and rubber gloves and Dixie cups. And basically, go ahead, boys, use at your discretion.
What was Congressmember Frank Riggs' comment on the situation since this happened in his office?
Well, Congressman Riggs was very adamant that we hadn't been nonviolent, and basically was having this message put out all over the media on the floor of Congress. But the video has shown that we were, and that activists entering the office that morning said good morning to the secretaries and, you know, had a peaceful sit-in. And the point where it got violent was when the officers decided to use excessive force on people.
Spring, as I said, we're also joined by Karen Pickett, who's with the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters, though we're focusing on this case because it is in court today as the protesters are suing Humboldt County officials. They were there for a reason, as Spring was just describing. Would you like to elaborate on that and where the struggle around the Headwaters issue is at today?
Good morning, Amy. I think that the, you know, what's at stake here is what the real issue in the case is. Obviously, we have to defend people's rights to nonviolently protest. But the reason that people were staging this sit-in and the reason that they took such dramatic action is because of what's at stake. And there's millions of years of evolution lying on the ground up in Humboldt County. And the Headwaters deal that Spring referred to, the people were protesting, is really kind of coming to a head now, in that it was announced in September of 96, and this deal would allocate $380 million of taxpayer money, both from the federal government and the state government, for a small portion of Headwaters Forest that is small enough to not be a biologically viable piece of forest. It would really be just a museum piece. So it's, you know, a politically expedient way to quote-unquote save Headwaters Forest, but it doesn't save Headwaters Forest. But what sets a worse precedent and even more spells doom for the forest, besides the small acreage that's set aside, are the conditions that are attached to the deal. And it's one of those conditions that we're in the midst of dealing with right now, the Habitat Conservation Plan, the approval of which is a contingency of the Headwaters deal being finalized. And while the words might sound good, what Habitat Conservation Plans actually are is management plans written by and for the corporation, and there are ways that developers and those in the extractive industry, like the logging industry and the mining industry, get around the Endangered Species Act. And what's included in a Habitat Conservation Plan is an incidental take permit, which is a license to kill endangered species. So it's essentially looking at what should be protected by federal law and crafting an agreement whereby some of the habitat of the species can be destroyed and some of those species, some of the populations, can be killed. So it benefits Charles Hurwitz. He gets hundreds of millions of dollars and gets a management plan that would allow him to log more of his land than he would if our laws, particularly the Endangered Species Act, were fully enforced. So we're dealing with that now because the draft Habitat Conservation Plan was just released and is in comment period, and we're coming up on public hearings. And we've been opposing the funding at the state level here in California because without conditions that would protect the species, and it locks into place for a very long time these very bad management practices.
Karen Pickett with us. She is with the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters. Karen, what sets Headwaters apart?
Well, it's an ecosystem that's very limited in its geographic range. It's even more limited now than it used to be before the age of industrial logging. It just goes along the coast in California from the Oregon border down to Big Sur. It was once 2 million acres. There's less than 4% left now, and it's unique to California. So we're not only seeing the last of the ancient redwoods in California on the chopping block, but it's the last of the ancient redwoods in the world, because coastal redwoods, this particular species, only grows on the coast of California. What that means in part is that, I mean, it's an endangered ecosystem. It's not just the endangered species, but there are other species like the coho salmon, like the marbled murrelet, and many others that are dependent on the redwood forest and dependent on the mix of ages and species that occur in the old growth redwood forest. So these species are very much pushed to the very brink of extinction because there's just these fragments of habitat left. And the fisheries in California are a shadow of what they used to be, so that, you know, the repercussions go on and on. It's not just the species. There are also, you know, the communities are in very rough shape up there. The economic base is has nearly been destroyed. So it's, you know, the jobs issue is actually not the jobs in the logging industry, but the jobs that are being lost are those in the fishing industry primarily.
Let me bring Spring back into the conversation. 17 years old, you were pepper sprayed. You've been involved in this issue for how long?
Well, I've grown up in Humboldt County, and I've seen just in that short period of time, in the last several years, how much has been lost. And this is why we must kind of break out of that comfortable shell and go to the front lines and put our bodies on the line and try to educate about this issue and try to stop it. So I've been doing this for several years. I never expected that our peaceful protest would result in pepper spray, but then again, there has been an escalation of force over the last couple years in Humboldt County by law enforcement, especially when we've gotten more and more support and growing numbers coming for our big rallies in September.
When is the next rally planned?
Well, with the hearings coming up, we're going to have a lot of people out at those Habitat Conservation Plan hearings, and you can bet When they're in the forest, we'll be there.
Has the pepper spray, the way that it has been used, has it slowed down protests? Are people afraid to get involved with the kind of civil disobedience that you engaged in last November?
You know, I think that that was mainly the point of why this was done, to mete out punishment and to discourage further protests and to chill people's civil rights. I do think people are very scared that this happened, and it is a growing trend, not just in nonviolent protests, but in the overall issue of police misconduct and misuse of this tool. But we've seen so much action and nonviolent resistance for the forest since then. We have Julia Butterfly sitting in the Luna tree sit for months and months. And
right, we've had her on several times. She's, what, now up to something like 8 months?
Yep, it's getting there. And we have people in the woods. Aside from Julia, I mean, almost every day people are talking to workers. I go down to Scotia, which is Pacific Lumber's company logging town, every week, and I sit in front of the mill and I table and I talk about jobs with the mill workers, and we're making connections. People are coming over to my house for dinner, and we're starting to talk about these things, because in Humboldt County, it's a dying industry, and it's also a dying forest.
Today, you're in court. What are you asking for in this civil suit?
We want to create precedent that says this is wrong and says this must not be done. My fear is that Humboldt County will spark other pepper sprayings across the country on nonviolent people. And if violent people are already being pepper sprayed when this substance hasn't been tested adequately, and then nonviolent people are now being pepper sprayed, that's pretty much the whole spectrum. That's the whole public. That's anybody. And that's really scary to me.
How much are you asking for in damages?
We haven't outlined a money price. I feel that the jury will decide if this was wrong and hopefully send a message to Humboldt County that they can't do this again.
If people want to go to your website, where can they go?
That's www.peppersprayvictims.org.
Not hard to remember. www.peppersprayvictims.org. And Karen Pickett of the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters, if people want to find out more overall about Headwaters.
Well, we have a Headwaters hotline that's updated constantly, and we'll have news of the trial as well as direct actions and the Habitat Conservation Plan hearings and rallies. And that number is 510-835-6303.
One more time.
510-835-6303.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Karen Pickett with the Coalition, the Bay Area Coalition for the Headwaters and Spring in court today, will be testifying in the civil case. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and in keeping with the theme of people who are protesting around the country. As you know, we often get calls from people telling us about actions that have taken place or about to take place. We got this call last week, the day after Hiroshima Day. It was the 53rd anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
This is Elmer Moss calling. I'm in Denver, Colorado, and I'm calling to let you know about a plowshares action that happened yesterday, August 6th, on Hiroshima Day, at a Minuteman III nuclear missile silo northeast of Denver. It's in one of the field that's controlled by the Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but the missile silo itself, number N7, is actually in Colorado. Two peace activists, Daniel Seekin and Sachio Koyen. Daniel is from Brattleboro, Vermont, and Sachio is from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Both entered the silo about 6 o'clock yesterday morning and did significant disarmament by hammering and stenciling with their own blood on the launching pad itself. They damaged and disarmed structures on top of the launching pad that are related to the launching mechanisms themselves, as well as other security devices apparently on top of the pad. They were arrested yesterday morning and held incommunicado all day. We got a phone call late last evening from them, and they were taken from the. They were held, and they had to meet with FBI. The FBI tried to interrogate them all day long in Greeley, Colorado, and then they were moved to the Denver City Jail last night.
That again, Elmer Moss, spokesperson for the Plowshares, a call we got about an action that took place on the 53rd anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And if you'd like to call us, leave a comment or let us know about protests that have taken place or will be taking place, we do have a comment line, and that number is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives. Call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Coming up next, we'll take a look at the African countries where the bombs exploded last week, in Tanzania and in Kenya. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Listener-sponsored radio, 94.1 FM, KPFA. The time is 9:41 a.m. Coming up next, David McBurney and Music of the World. That's from 10 until 12. And at 1, on Future Unfolding, it's Exploration, the World of Science and Technology with Dr. Michio Kaku. And now back to Democracy Now!
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as you know, two bombs exploded last week, one in Tanzania, one in Kenya. It's interesting, today in the New York Times, there is a photograph of a Kenyan man holding a sign that says, that asks the question about why, if there was an attack against the United States, it took place in Kenya. It says, go fight Americans in America. Well, today, as we did yesterday, we're going to take a look at Kenya and also at Tanzania. We're joined by two guests. Mumia Shamaka is with us. He is an African historian from Kenya, an African economist as well. And we're joined on the telephone by Dr. Richard Mshamba, who is a professor of economics at La Salle University, born and raised in Tanzania. He was recently in Kenya doing research for his upcoming book, Africa in the Global Economy. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Dr. Mshamba. Can you tell us about Tanzania?
Yes. First of all, good morning.
It's good to be with you.
As you mentioned, yes, between July 4th and July 22nd, I was both in Kenya and Tanzania. In Kenya conducting research and in Tanzania visiting with my relatives. But essentially the situation in Tanzania was very calm. There, since elections were conducted in 1995 and the next elections are going to be in year 2000, there wasn't even a lot of political debate going on. There was a lot of discussion about the economic situation and especially about the recently instituted tax system, value-added tax. But the country was as peaceful as usual. So, yes, this came as a big shock, as I'm sure it was to everyone.
Place Tanzania geographically in East Africa.
Okay. First of all, Tanzania is a big country, about seven times the size of New York State. It is in East Africa, and it borders Kenya is on the north, and also Uganda. On the north is Uganda and Kenya. And on the west, there is Burundi, Rwanda, and the former Zaire, now Democratic Republic of Congo. And in the south, there is Zambia, Malawi, and Mozambique. And, of course, in the east, it is the Indian Ocean. The population of Tanzania is about 30 million people. It is a very diverse country in terms of ethnic groups. There are about 126 ethnic groups, which means there are about 126 different languages spoken. Fortunately, Swahili is spoken throughout the country, and that is the language which unites Tanzanians. And one can also say the fact that there are many ethnic groups, no single ethnic group dominates the rest, as is the case in other parts of Africa.
Dr. Mshamba, you talk about doing your work in Kenya for your book, Africa and the Global Economy, and visiting your family in Tanzania. What are the connections, besides border, between Kenya and Tanzania?
Well, the connection goes, really, one can almost say many centuries, but just looking at the colonial era, the two countries were both under the British rule. As we know, Tanzania got independence in 1961 and Kenya in 1963. So because of the proximity, the geographical proximity, and the shared colonial history, there is a substantial amount of trade between Tanzania and Kenya. In fact, between 1967 and 1977, there was an East African community, which was a customs union between the three countries, Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda. Unfortunately, because of a number of factors, and if I can just mention very briefly, one is the political differences, because Tanzania was moving towards socialism and Kenya towards capitalism, and Uganda, there was the dictator Idi Amin. That contributed to the collapse of East African community. And there were also other factors, such as how the benefits of the community were shared. Tanzania and Uganda felt that most of the benefits were going to Kenya.
Amy, I'd like, if you, how are you doing, Richard?
I'm fine.
Yeah.
This is Mumia Shamaka, Kenyan historian.
In Washington. Amy, I would like to interject, just highlight Richard's point about the similarities between Tanzania and Kenya. For a long, long time, there were no boundaries, as you all know, in Africa. So, particularly between Uganda Tanzania and Kenya, the Maasai don't know the boundaries between the two countries. They still traverse between the two countries very freely. That's how they have lived all the while. But what is important here is that the existence of a lack of war between the two countries, Tanzania and Kenya, they have been considered for a long time as peaceful countries in that region, and very much out of, yes, they were in the Cold War, mixed between the East and West, but as the Cold War has waned, they have maintained good relations between themselves and among other countries in Africa, and particularly with the West. But what has become very attractive, perhaps, to the terrorist-type actions we saw last week is the apparent, actually the obvious vulnerability of the American interests in these countries. And I think that, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, that Africans, particularly East Africans, Kenyans and Tanzanians, have been very sympathetic to people in the Middle East. to a point where I think the Middle East has helped a lot of programs in these countries. Now, there is emerging an erosion of that sympathy as these things start happening, so that you find that much of this aid comes to religious organizations in these countries. They are targeting religious Muslim organizations, churches. They don't go to national programs. And then Kenya has already suffered, I think, one bombing incident in 1980, when I think some Arabic organization bombed a very prominent hotel in Nairobi. And it happens that that hotel is owned by, I think, some Israelis or some Jews. And it was bombed because Kenya collaborated with Israel to enable Israel to attack Uganda and rescue the hostages there. And as a result, Kenya suffered that kind of blow.
That happened in what, 1979?
1980.
Uh-huh.
And now we have this. And I think there is a very, some kind of bitterness now surfacing that whatever sympathy the Africans, the Kenyans have for the Middle Eastern people, I think is starting to erode, especially when you see this kind of thing happening. And I think that sign, poster you alluded to,
Go Fight Americans,
yes,
in America,
expresses the what is now becoming a common sentiment among the general public.
Now, I wanted to ask something that I've heard about only in passing. I saw a line in the New York Times on Sunday which said that several Kenyan rescue workers complain that the American Marines and other American officials had done little to help them extricate people from the Afundi house and had even prevented them from taking dead Kenyan nationals out of the embassy building and from searching for survivors there. This concern that though the overwhelming number of casualties, dead and also injured, thousands are Kenyan and not American, that the research, rescue efforts were originally targeted at saving the Americans.
Yes, that's true. I think there are two things going on at the same time. The first is that the American officials at the embassy were primarily concerned with the security of the embassy. Of course, there are highly classified documents when in that building, and when something like this happened, perhaps papers have been blown all over, and they don't want that exposed. So that was taken into consideration by the American officials. The second one is the rescue of the injured. And I think Kenyans felt like when they saw, I guess, American bodies coming out, they don't see Kenyans, who are the majority in the embassy at the time, and that they happen to be that they are the most who are affected in the inside that building. They felt like they were not taking the same amount of care and concern for the Kenyans inside. Now, and I think it boiled over when they saw Americans being airlifted to Germany, to South Africa, and Africans are being sent to local hospitals, which didn't have some of the equipment and the facilities.
I think they said they could handle maybe in an emergency 60, and we're talking in the range of 4,000 to 5,000.
Yes, so, and then that's when that kind of observations were made, that it wasn't fair that they would take their own and leave people who are working for them, who have sacrificed their lives for them. And I think afterward, the Americans changed, they were starting to take some of the Americans, Kenyans overseas. So there is a great deal in the heat of the moment. I think Africans felt they were not being treated fairly, and the Americans, I think, decided to change that. There is another factor here that I think we should also consider, and that points to the idea of how secure should these embassies? And I think it's been much talked about. If you see it on the net, in the talk shows, it's much talked about. Many cases, the American embassies in developing countries have become more of the indigenous people don't feel as easily welcome there as they should, and they feel like they are there just to serve the elite of the society. So so if these buildings were made as the fortresses, I think it would simply isolate the people they are supposed to be feeling closer to, much more so than I think they are now. So it's a very difficult balance that the countries can really strike to mingle with the people at the same time.
Mumia
Shimaka,
just on that point,
Mumia Shimaka speaking with us from Washington, Kenyan historian, now Dr. Richard Mashamba, professor of economics at La Salle University from Tanzania.
Right. One thing, I'll make a couple of points. Regarding security issues, of course, I'm not an expert in that area, but just to highlight what Mumia just said about those places not feel isolated. On the 22nd of July, I had a meeting with the economic counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, and I had to go through two security checks, and someone had to come from upstairs, you know, maybe fourth floor or whatever floor, to come down and bring me to this person's office. And I felt that there was just too much security for me, given that I was going there for research. Now, so in other words, yes, when something like this happens, something very horrible, something that we cannot even explain, there is a tendency of trying to think that maybe it was preventable. And maybe it is, it was, but really, I don't know. It is also very, very difficult for something which is this evil and this irrational to try to say what the motive was, because first of all, at this point we don't even know who did it. But just in terms of the presence of people from the Middle East and the Arab world in East Africa, and I'm saying this, I have to be very careful, because I'm not saying that we know the bombs were planted by people from that area. I think what explains their presence now in East Africa is not necessarily that because East Africa is sympathetic with the Middle East, but I think it is explained more by what I want to call a trade liberalization in most of Africa, which has made it easier for people from other parts of the world to invest in those countries. And I'm not saying that that is necessarily bad, but I'm just saying I think that explains more why there is an increased presence, not only from the Middle East, because there are a lot of people also from Asia who are conducting business in East Africa, more so than, say, even just 5 years ago.
In our last few minutes, I just wanted to comment on the fact that Kenya and Tanzania hail the two of the greatest elder statesmen of Africa. We're talking about Jomo Kenyatta, the founding president of Kenya, and Julius Nyerere, the founding president of Tanzania. Mumia Shimaka, would you care to comment?
Well, I call that benevolent democracy. I wouldn't call what Kenyatta did as a democracy. But again, I have to preface my remarks by stating that Kenya was simply emerging out of colonial rule, a very bitter colonial rule. I think all of you have heard about Mau Mau in the 50s, which fought the British, and a lot of Kenyans were killed. I guess you could equate that to the Revolutionary War of the U.S. And I think, if anything, it set a stage for what followed, that benevolent democracy whereby it wasn't total democracy per se, so much as ruling by decrees to an extent. And that also paved the way for the peaceful, I think, life that the country led. But it also should be mentioned that Kenyans have been very reluctant to get to internal wars like Sudan, Somalia, Uganda, Zaire, and all other countries that have surrounded, except Tanzania, of course. And they have seen that devastation and destruction of families and property, and they are very reluctant, in spite of the ethnic clashes that still go on today. They are very reluctant to get into all war throughout the country. And so, if anything, he can be credited for not waging war against the British who had settled there and became Kenyans. Some still live there, are Kenyans.
Just quickly, because I think
we have 20 seconds.
Yes, I just want to say, even though one can cite some areas where they can criticize Nyerere as far as the political policies go, but personally, I think he is a blessing to Tanzania and to Africa.
Yeah, that's very true. He's very steady hand. Very good example.
And on that note, I want to thank you both for joining us. Kenyan historian Mumia Shimaka from Washington, Dr. Richard Mashamba, professor of economics at LaSalle University from Tanzania, writing a book called Africa and the Global Economy. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Michelle Garcia, our web spinner. Julie Drizin, our executive director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
KPFA thanks you for your contributions during our most recent Summer Celebration Fund Drive. And as a reminder, please pay your pledge.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Nicole Sewell.